From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, the Indianapolis Children's Choir and the Indiana Historical Society are ready for the holidays, and we learn about a moving partnership between Ivy Tech art students and Community North Hospital. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of this and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Today, topics both sweet and sassy as we journey from poisonous creatures to a Christmas story. But first, like a lot of people, Indianapolis author Jeff Rasley has gotten tired of uncivil discourse. Unlike a lot of people, he tried to do something about it. His experiment is documented in his new book, Polarized, The Case for Civility in the Time of Trump, An Experiment in Civil Discourse on Facebook. Contributor Mark Allen talked to Rasley about his experiment.
So your book is called The Case for Civility in the Time of Trump, An Experiment in Civil Discourse on Facebook. So my first thought is civil discourse on Facebook seems as likely as peace in the Middle East, but go ahead. Tell us what you did in this experiment.
Social media has not been exactly a place where you see a lot of civil discourse, but I thought I'll give it a try. So shortly after the inauguration of President Trump, I put up an invitation to friends, and at that time I had 650 so-called Facebook friends, and invited them to participate in a series of discussions about particular political topics. And my goal was to get people from both sides, Clinton voters, Trump voters, and anybody else, to see could we have civil conversations about political topics in this era of hyperpolarization.
And I note in some topics you did have nice conversations, but in some it was just too polarized, right? Is that a fair assessment?
Well, the way it divided is most of the topics that we addressed, it for the most part divided along pro-Trump and anti-Trump lines. Now, there were some exceptions, but that held pretty much no matter what the topic was. And interestingly, abortion was the topic that had the most crossovers. A significant number of pro-Trump voters were pro-choice on that issue. But where it would get angry and polarized, and my one rule was you are not supposed to attack any of the other participants personally. Where that boundary would get pushed is when it was anything specifically about Trump. So, for example, one of our topics was Russian collusion, and was, you know, what do you think of the evidence as far as was there collusion with the Trump campaign and the Russians? And the responses were pretty angry, and people would make responses kind of categorizing all Trump voters. But they did follow the rule of not attacking an individual personally.
So that's something,
yeah.
Right?
Okay. It's something.
Yeah. you ask in the book, can Facebook be a medium to reduce political polarization, or is it designed to tempt users to express themselves impulsively and angrily about political issues? And I would guess it's the latter, but What were your findings?
Yeah, exactly. The way social media is set up is to tempt people into impulsive, immediate responses. I mean, you do have the opportunity to edit a response, and you know, people do use that. But for the most part, what I found is people responded impulsively, and I do too. I mean, my own personal experience is I see something that irritates me or upsets me that I want to respond to. I start banging away on my keyboard. And because social media is such a new form of communication, it really hasn't developed rules of civility. You know, when we're in personal offline conversations, we've grown up with hundreds of unwritten rules, norms on how to behave with each other so that we can engage in civilized behavior and conversations. Social media is so new, those sorts of mores and customs are just beginning to develop. So that was one of my ideas, was to try to help by proposing this rule that we have civil conversations and we do not launch personal attacks on each other in those discussion threads.
You were writing about how some of the people you like and respect, some of your friends, doctors, lawyers, business owners, professors with PhDs, voted for Trump, which is interesting. You wrote, "Here are examples of friends I respect who voted for Trump and have given me coherent reasons for doing so. One World War II vet and Bronze Star awardee. Two, retired doctor who gives countless hours of volunteer medical treatment. Three, brilliant linguist who retired to devote her life to philanthropy. And four, builder manager who specializes in Section 8 housing for the poor." Must have been illuminating, maybe a little shocking, maybe a little alarming to find that those people did. Did you feel any better when they explained to you why they did what they did?
Yeah, the common theme among those four and almost every Trump supporter that I interviewed for the book or conversed with on Facebook gave this reason: economics. They think that the Democratic Party is moving the country in the wrong direction toward excessive regulation, excessive taxation. These folks probably would have voted for whoever the Republicans nominated as opposed to Hillary Clinton, and probably whoever the Democratic Party nominated, unless the parties broke out of those two molds. So, you know, I don't necessarily agree with that reasoning, but I understand it and I respect it.
You know, and this is interesting. Your book is interesting to me, particularly because I took the exact opposite approach to this. When after the election, I got off Facebook and I shut my Twitter down. I got off Facebook. My feeling was, I didn't want to hear from the people who were happy with the results, and I didn't want to hear from the people who were angry with the results. I just didn't want to wallow in it. I wanted to get away from it as much as possible. So, I guess what I want to ask you is what do you think of that as a solution, just walking away from it?
That was my initial reaction too. But when I experienced things like going to Thanksgiving dinner at my mom's home and being informed that we could not talk about politics because of a split within my own family, I thought, we've reached a point where it's unhealthy. And if we all just walk away from it, that level of unhealthy polarization is not going to be reduced. So I thought, this is one little thing one person could try, throw the pebble into the pond. Maybe it would spread. Donald Trump is our president. Like it or not, it might change with an impeachment or the next election. But in the meantime, I don't think it's healthy for our nation for us to be able or not to be able to talk with each other just because of who we voted for, no matter how strongly we feel about which way the election went.
Contributor Mark Allen with author Jeff Rasley. He's the same Jeff Rasley who is offering a course through the Indiana Writers Center to help you write your memoir. Polarized, The Case for Civility in the Time of Trump, an Experiment in Civil Discourse on Facebook, is available on Amazon.com. The Indiana Historical Society has transformed its Glick Indiana History Center into a wonderland full of holiday treats for young and old alike. I invited Tom Borman, IHS Director of Events and Donor Relations, to talk about the Festival of Trees, which he's shepherded since its beginning, and Marianne Scheline, IHS Program Specialist, to tell us about a celebration of a Christmas story and the Good Beers and Ugly Sweaters party and more. Tom, before we turned on the microphones, you told me about the exponential growth in the Festival of Trees. How long ago did it start?
Well, it began in 2014 with 25 trees. The next year it doubled to 50. Then last year 72. And this year we have 80 trees plus one centerpiece tree. The 80 trees are all done by sponsors. The centerpiece tree is in Lilly Hall, and it's 30 feet tall.
Wow.
And it has a special feature that you can walk through it. And if you'd like to stop while you're walking through the tree, under the mistletoe, you can steal a kiss.
Oh, that's so sweet. And what was the – how did this idea come about, this Festival of Trees?
Well, I think it came about through one of our trustees and also trying to find ways to engage people at the holidays and bring them into the Indiana Historical Society. And they had visited, they meaning the trustee and some other members, had visited some other Festival of Trees throughout the state. Ours is different in that so many of the festivals will auction their trees. So they're on display for a very short time.
Mm-hmm.
Our festival, we provide a pre-lit tree to all sponsors, and the trees are decorated, and right now they're on display from, well, they begin November 17th and mm-hmm. will go through January 6th.
That's great. So they don't go away to
no.
someone's home before
no.
Christmas.
And we don't have to water them.
And they're not a fire hazard, right? So they're all different themes. What's the wildest theme this year or the most unusual?
Whoa, that's a hard one. There are many unusual ones this year. We range, because we have told people, even though the theme is Festival of Trees, a tree does not have to be a tree. So we have some very symbolic trees, anywhere from a tree made of tires.
A tree made
from mm-hmm. a ladder. We have fabricated trees out of steel. They run the gamut.
Wow. And you ask visitors, you ask your guests to vote on their favorite trees.
That's right. Visitors at the inn can select three trees, not in a particular order,
mm-hmm.
but then at the end of Festival of Trees, it is tallied, and there is one that will emerge the grand champion.
Yeah. And I love that this is such a, you know, such a family-friendly event. People can look for the German pickle ornaments. There are all kinds of other activities. And, Marianne, mm-hmm. I know you've been working on lots and lots of them, including some that are inspired by the film A Christmas Story.
Yeah, so we're doing A Christmas Story Day, and that'll be on December 16th. And so from noon to 4, people can come in. We're going to have various activities. So we're going to do a Christmas Story movie trivia game so people can test out their trivia and how many times they've really paid attention during those 24-hour airings of
Wait,
A Christmas Story.
I think we might be about to give an answer to a trivia question, but it's a very Hoosier thing to see, right?
It is, correct. It is definitely based in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
It was filmed in Ohio, but based in Indiana.
Oh, those Buckeyes.
I know. So, and even in Northwest Indiana, when you come in through Chicago, there's a statue of one of the characters' tongue stuck to a pole.
And you're working on, this is it okay to talk about this?
Sure.
You're working on an activity?
I'm going for a goal. I'd like to show a little science experiment of how that works, of how, you know, sticking the tongue to the metal pole caused him to be frozen there. So if all goes well, we're going to test that out in the next couple of weeks before we air it. But from my online sources and science teacher sources, they all say it should work. So I'm excited for that.
Well, now that's something I would picture maybe a little boy of about 4 or 5 mm-hmm. doing, as in the film. But you also have something that's just for grown-ups. Can we talk about the ugly sweater event?
Good Beers and Ugly Sweaters. This is our 4th year that we're going to be having this event. It's become quite kind of a signature event for the Festival of Trees time of year. So we invite guests to wear their ugliest Christmas sweater. We have lots of other activities going on, including karaoke, but one of the things we do is we just have tons of beer that folks can try out. So we'll have 7 different breweries coming, and then at the end, after lots of photo ops and fun times, then we'll vote for the best ugly sweater.
Tell me about your own ugly sweater.
My own, it changes each year. I've done different ones. I've made my own that's like where I've made myself look like a snow globe. I've used plastic wrap and I created like my own little look around. So there's different options. But
Tom, no pressure or anything, but you better be working on something to beat the snow globe sweater.
Right.
The Indiana Historical Society's Tom Borman and Marianne Scheline. Find out if your tongue will stick to a cold pole, check out the Festival of Trees, and wear your ugliest sweater to quaff some microbrews at the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana History Center. The Festival of Trees continues through January 6th. Get those sweaters ready for December 14th and reread Hoosier Gene Shepherd's A Christmas Story by the Light of a Leg Lamp to get ready for the screening and other fun on December 16th. Craft programs, the Elf on the Shelf, and Lucky Pickle Ornaments a la German tradition are all part of the fun. Get more details at indianahistory.org. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Coming up, scientist Christy Wilcox's parents realized early on that their girl was made of more than sugar and spice and everything nice. But right now, I hope you're not hungry, because Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Lisa Moyer, owner of Griner's, the longtime Southside sub shop. This entrepreneur is also the brains behind Scout's Food Truck, the Bark Truck, Mac Genie, the new Dog Deli, and the new Cook and Baker Truck.
Tell me a little bit about Griner's, a Southside classic. Now, that sub shop has been around a long, long time. What's the history of Griner's?
Well, the sub shop's been around since 1969, and it's kind of like a puzzle for me. I gather as much information as I can over the years, and I had someone as recent as a month ago that came in that had more history to date than anyone's been able to give me.
About the shop?
About the shop, yeah. And he used to work there, and he gave me the entire history on the original location, the franchises, which were franchises, which weren't. And then also recently, when I announced our new second store opening, one of the Griner grandchildren contacted me and friended me on Facebook. So I continue to learn. It's a learning experience for me. And often I'll tell customers that come in, and they all tend to measure how tall they were since they've been coming in. And I tell them, you have really more history than I do with Griner's. I'm into this 3-plus years now, but I never get tired of learning about it. And in its own way, it's an institution since 1969.
Now, so, there were franchises or other locations?
There weren't a lot of franchises, but
there were other locations?
Yes, I did. There were several other locations. I heard there was a location in Japan, I guess I'll have to fly over there to verify that or not. But there were some franchise locations, and it's my understanding that and franchising, of course, doesn't matter if it's in the 70s or if it's now. It's not always the easiest thing to get off the ground, and those didn't last forever.
Well, no, there was one, I think, on the east side that people talk about, right?
Yes, there was one on Shadlin, and that's the technically that was the original one.
Oh, okay.
And there's a pizza place in that building now, and if you look at their sign, it's in the shape of a submarine.
Oh, my goodness.
And just as ours, of course, I didn't really catch that until a year after I owned it. I thought, oh, my gosh, that looks like a submarine.
Uh-huh. Sub shop.
So,
right?
Yeah,
I get it. Right?
And there was one on Keystone. And, you know, they've kind of been all over. But the only one standing was the one on Shelby and Raymond. And I knew I knew that I was supposed to buy it.
Why? How did you know that?
You know, you had to just be in my boots that day. I walked in. I didn't even taste the bread yet, and I didn't taste the sandwich. And I say taste the bread because our DNA comes from our bread.
You are known for your bread, right?
We're known for the bread. The bread's amazing.
Because you bake it there every day.
Every day. Every day someone bakes bread. And when I came on, they were baking it, I think, 4 days a week and freezing and warming it the other. And that was one of the first things that I changed. Within the first year, we started baking it every day, and I was willing to lose money because, you know, that's the DNA of Griners. If you don't have that, then you're a sandwich shop.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and coming up, what if we could use art to make patients feel calmer at the hospital? But right now, Christy Wilcox, author of Venomist, How Earth's Deadliest Creatures Mastered Biochemistry, spoke at Butler University's Schrott Center a few weeks ago as part of their Woods Lecture Series, and Jill Dittmeyer got the deadly scoop. I can't wait to hear this.
She's a really interesting person, and it's a really interesting speaker series. And as a matter of fact, they've gathered authors, scientists, activists, and Christy kicked it all off. She is a marine biologist, a venomous scientist, and author of the book Venomous, How Earth's Deadliest Creatures Mastered Biochemistry. Now, Christy told me that when she was a kid, she loved to look into the mouths of dead geckos and study their tongues. And obviously
someone's interested in that. I'm glad.
She was interested in that, and she also was never afraid of snakes.
You could sort of think of it like an alcoholic beverage too, like a cocktail, right? You know, you go to a specialty bar that's got, you know, fancy cocktails, and they're putting, you know, half a shot of this and a teeny bit of this, and they're mixing these amazing mixtures that then, when they hit your palate, are incredible, right? They're these great different flavors. Well, it's like that, except you're talking about toxins and you're talking about doing horrible things to your body. So some of them are able to completely paralyze a person in less than 5 minutes. Others can tear through flesh and cause these giant, awful wounds. Each one is sort of fine-tuning their chemical cocktail to do what they want to get the result that they need, whether it's stopping an animal in its tracks or digesting an animal or a little bit of both.
And how does something that seems so horrible and bad turn into something good for humans?
Well, so what's really interesting about these is that they have very specific actions on various parts of our body. So if you take something like how your body clots blood, there's a lot of different little steps in each little tiny thing that's involved in the blood clotting cascade. If something goes wrong with it, your blood either doesn't clot or it clots way too much. Well, that happens all the time. I mean, we have people that have disorders in their clotting, and that's something that needs to be treated. And these animals have compounds that are designed to mess with the clotting system, right? So they're designed to target these same targets. And so if you're looking for a drug to, say, you know, help someone who has uncontrolled hemorrhaging, well, you might want to try to find a venom that causes clotting. And then you might be able to find a compound that does the very specific thing you need it to do to fix that person's problem.
Obviously, clotting, that's one example. Can you give me a couple of other examples of medicines or procedures that people might go, wow, I had no idea that that's where it came from?
Yeah. So one of the most common venom-derived drugs on the market is captopril, which is a hypertension drug. It lowers blood pressure, and it came from a viper in South America whose main feature is that it drops blood pressure. It basically puts its small animal, its prey items, into shock by causing massive drops in blood pressure. And they were able to isolate the compound that makes that blood pressure drop, formulate it in a way so that you can control that drop, and then now it's used to lower blood pressure in people. And that's sort of the classic example, and that was the first well-known example. But there's a lot more. There's now a molecule from cone snail venom, for example. Cone snails have a really unique paralytic venom because they are snails. You think of snails as slow, but they're snails that get to eat fish. And they actually catch fish. And they can stop a fish basically dead in its tracks as soon as they sting it. And some of those compounds while they work on fish muscles as paralytics, it turns out they only target certain ion channels that in our muscles are only, or in our body, are only found in pain neurons. And so they have this particular compound that stops the nerve's transmission of pain. And so it's a very, very potent painkiller called Prialt. Those are some of the really interesting ones. One of my favorites is not actually using the toxic action, but using a toxin from the Deathstalker scorpion. A guy named Jim Olson up at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Washington found this particular toxin that seems to, for unknown reasons, bind to tumor cells. And it binds to them very, very strongly and a variety of different types of tumors. And what he did is he took that compound, that toxin, and he attached a fluorescent molecule to it. So like GFP, but I think he uses a slightly different one. And it's called BLZ-100, and it's a tumor paint. And so what he's been doing with it, they've been running clinical trials that have been going really well. They can inject it into cancer patients, and it sets the tumors aglow, basically. So then when the surgeon opens up and says, all right, what do I need to cut? It's cut the bright blue stuff, not just trying to see where the tumor is. And it's really, really proving to be a game changer, it seems, for some of the tough breast cancers, pediatric brain tumors, things that are usually really, really, really hard to spot and to make sure you get all of the tumor. Because if you go in there to do surgery and you don't get all of the tumor, you've just done a major surgery and you're going to have to do it again.
Because we do hear a lot about precision medicine, which is mm-hmm. the way of the future for looking at our own DNA and finding the best diagnosis, best cure rates, best practices for individual people. And this all kind of wraps itself into that, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and part of a lot of the things that are going wrong in medicine right now, I mean, you look at something like the opioid crisis. Well, part of the problem is we need painkillers. We need to be able to manage pain. But our painkillers do a lot. They don't just do one tiny thing. They do a lot of things, and they can be dangerous for that reason. Opioids have a lot of off-target effects, is what they call it, or side effects, right? Some of these potential neurotoxins from venoms might be able to shut off just pain neurons very specifically and not cause anything else to happen. And if you could do that, if you could find those molecules that would work like that, I mean, you could have painkillers that are more potent than morphine, but don't have the same side effects.
Believe it or not, venomous science is an up-and-coming field, and many medicines have been created out of these finds. So it's actually a very exciting kind of science, and one that definitely appeals to a lot of students that are at Butler now. So she had a good turnout for that, and once again, we'll see what else they create from that. One of the other speakers that I spoke to in that series was Margaret Lohman. They call her Canopy Meg, and she is all about preserving forests all around the world, and she had a lot to say about our forest preservation here in Indiana, too, and we're going to hear from her in a couple of weeks right here on The Art of the Matter.
Fantastic. Well, you know what? We have lots of things coming up that you can go out and see and do. Many of them revolve around the upcoming holidays. On our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
Hearing your conversation with Christy Wilcox reminds me that the poison exhibit at the Indiana State Museum might make a fun outing to learn more about toxins and poisons and all that kind of great science stuff. That's part of the State Museum is featuring the Year of Science this year.
And now open in the Stutz Building in downtown Indianapolis, the 10th West Gallery. It's fine contemporary art from a dozen local artists. You can check that out. And if we haven't given you enough options, you can find more online at the indiearts.org website, indiearts.org/guide. Or guess what? We'll be back again next week with that calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Coming up, how Ivy Tech artists and Community North healthcare professionals discovered an innovative partnership. But first, contributor Shannon Forsell talks with artistic director Josh Petty about the Indianapolis Children's Choir's lineup of holiday performances.
So, Josh, I mean, for me personally, I love hearing a choir at the holidays.
Of course.
And so, you know, you're going to provide that for
us. Oh, yes. Definitely, we can do that for you.
Right. So the Indianapolis Children's Choir has been around for 32 years now.
Can you believe it?
It's fantastic. It's such a long, fantastic organization that serves so many students. And for me personally, you know, when I was in school, I wished that I had an opportunity like the Children's Choir to teach me all of the skills that are difficult to get in school. Especially nowadays.
Definitely.
So, but let's talk more about Christmas.
Yes.
So
the holidays.
You've got four shows.
We have four
that
shows.
People can see. Tell us about those.
So, the main shows are called Angel Sing. And those are the evening shows that are with our advanced choirs. So we have four advanced choirs, two treble choirs, women's ensemble, and then our mixed ensemble. And so those. Those will be at St. Luke's, and then we have two other concerts in on Saturday afternoon, which feature our younger choirs, the beginning level choirs, you know, first, second, third graders singing.
Who doesn't want to see that?
I know. They're really cute, and my daughter's in it, so, you know, it makes it even better. So those are on Saturday afternoon, but the theme this year for all of our holiday concerts is White Christmas, based on Bing Crosby's White Christmas. Mm-hmm. So you're going to hear familiar favorites, but maybe with a different twist to them. So, you know, you're going to hear, of course, the classic White Christmas. You're going to hear I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. You're going to hear What Child Is This? You know, some great classic Christmas carols, some great holiday favorites, but again, with a different twist to them.
That's fantastic. And those are in December 16 and, oh, December 15 and 16.
Correct.
Are all of those performances. And folks can get those tickets where?
The people can either go online to our website, www.iccchoir.org, or they can call our office, 940-9640, and order tickets.
And those tickets are on sale right now.
They can get those tickets on sale right now. We would love to see them there.
That's great. So get your seat for that fantastic show. Let's talk a little more about the Children's Choir. You're relatively new as the artistic director, although you've been there a very long time.
Yeah, 17 years with the choir overall, but this will be my second year as the artistic
How's
director.
How's that feeling? How's that going?
Well, everyone says that I have big shoes to fill, I'm doing my best at it. So we've changed some things a little bit. The old model of a choir coming on, singing, walking off, choir coming on, singing, walking off, just it's not what's exciting people right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are such a society where we're inundated with being stimulated constantly.
Right.
And so we've redone our performances. They're really more of shows now. When you come and you see the children's choir sing, it's an experience. It is not just, oh, there's a nice choir singing, and this piece has nothing to do with the next piece, has nothing to do with the next piece. There's always,
that's great.
There's a theme to it. There's a cohesiveness to it. And it really is a show. You come and you experience something different. So if you think you know what it's like to hear children singing, you may know that, but you've never seen a performance done like the Indianapolis Children's Choir does it.
That's fantastic. Yeah, you know, all of us have a harder time sitting for a long time than we used to. And so it's interesting. You do have to make changes to stay current with what your audience wants to see.
Exactly. And it's great to hear the audience go, oh, it's been an hour. I had no idea.
Oh, that's really good.
You know, because our performances flow from one piece into the next piece, and a choir moving on, and all of a sudden they're like, oh, wait, choir changed in front of me. When did that happen? And there are lighting cues and changes and all of that. So we're changing with the time and times, but still the artistic quality and the level of singing and the maturity of the singing is all there. It's still there.
That's fantastic. And is this a year-round program for...
It is. So we do take the summers off. Everyone needs a break in
right,
the summers.
Sure.
But the season begins in August. Singers come back in August, and then we will take our tours in June, and then they have July off.
Great. Well, if you're ready to think about the holidays, get your tickets now to see any of the four performances with the Indianapolis Children's Choir this holiday season.
Contributor Shannon Forsell with the Indianapolis Children's Choir's Artistic Director, Josh Petty. Learn about all their concerts at iccchoir.org, iccchoir.org. If you're very lucky, you'll never have the experience of looking up at the ceiling from a gurney traveling from one part of a hospital to another. But after a 1,000-foot bridge between Community North Hospital and Community Heart and Vascular opened early this year, the staff realized that amenities including specialty phones with dedicated Wi-Fi for emergency situations, emergent pharmacy supplies and an AED, and fogged and mirrored glass for patient privacy took care of patients' physical needs, but the hospital had a chance to take care of their psychological needs as well. Enter artists from Ivy Tech. Here are Community North's Sarah Ward and Ivy Tech's Stephanie Lewis Robertson to tell the story. So, Sarah, not that it was a problem, but in an artist's mind, it is a problem or a challenge. Tell us about the structure that ended up being paired with art as a solution.
Wonderful. Yes. So, we at Community Hospital North and Community Heart and Vascular Hospital, the facilities sit right next door to each other, and we have always had a desire to connect the two. So we broke ground in December of 2015. And in doing so, it took a little over a year to place the connector between the two facilities to connect that continuum of care.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about 1,000 square feet. Yeah, about 1,000 feet long, I guess I should say.
Mm-hmm.
1,000 feet long. It's a white sky bridge connector between the two facilities. And there's windows, there's soft lighting. But the thing about it was we needed something to bring it to life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really kind of just that white hallway tunnel. And so really wanted to enhance
and the people,
what that experience would be.
The people going through there are your doctors, your nurses, but also patients.
So the use of the tunnel is for patients to be transferred from either Community Hospital North over to Community Heart and Vascular Hospital or vice versa. And typically, why they would be transported, not always, but typically, it's because they're having a critical issue.
Mm.
And so they need a specialty at one of the facilities. In that experience, if you're having a significant life event, we felt like this long tunnel that's white, we just, you know, I say that
yeah.
and being very serious,
yeah.
you know, so to have art throughout that facility, I think it will create an environment that's warmer, that is adds life and personality to it. And so from the patient's perspective, we really wanted to do this. It's just as important to us that their experience of being transported to get that critical care be one that's calming.
And
it may be a scary situation.
Sure. And I would think it would be a better outcome for everybody, including the patients being transferred, the calmer they can be, the more centered they can be.
Correct. And, you know, a second usage with that connector is our staff. So we have staff that go to both hospitals. And so, you know, we want to create an experience for our staff as well. And so this is certainly something that we're looking forward to having in place, and we're just very grateful to Ivy Tech and Stephanie Robertson and the whole team. This has been, Stephanie, correct me if I'm wrong, more than 135 people or roughly 135 people who have touched this project. I think that in itself is one of the most significant pieces to this because we care for everybody.
Yeah.
And Stephanie afforded me an opportunity to speak to one of the classes, and when I looked around, I really saw every age, every ethnicity, and that made me feel better because we care for everybody. So
yeah.
I feel like this art project is definitely going to relate to anybody that comes through And so we're excited about that.
Mm-hmm. How did the idea of putting art in this connector first come up? And then how did Ivy Tech and Community North get connected?
So you might want to talk about what you asked your staff.
So the idea generated from it just being a white hallway. Again, you know, as a patient or as a staff member, we want to create environments that are healing. While the connector was functional, it still needed that extra life to it. And so we talked as an executive leadership team, and we said, let's ask our employees what they want to do. So we gave them options. It was, you know, the options range from, do we want to have a historical hallway of Indianapolis or Community Health Network, or do we want to reach out to a local school for their art program? So there was a variety of different choices. Overwhelmingly, our staff said, reach out to a school.
Wow.
Let it be a school, you know, connect with their art department. And so I want to say it was, in our survey, it was around 80, if not 90% of our staff said reach out.
How encouraging.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And I will also say that this is the quickest public art project that has ever come about because you contacted us around August 14th, and we met on August 27th, you and I and another faculty member.
Yes.
And then by October, we had paperwork signed and designs set and ideas. We didn't have the design completely set, but we actually have something we call Art Camp, the eighth week of classes, because that's our midterm week, and most of our students are cranky, and most of the faculty are cranky.
You think?
Yeah, just a little bit. And so for about 5 or 6 years, we've eliminated classes, but we've had workshops. Mm-hmm. So we decided we can do this during the workshop. So that week, we primed and painted and stenciled and silkscreened and collaged and painted and overpainted and over silkscreened 450 pieces to 466, we're not really sure, pieces of panels of wood that will be installed, and they will flow through the hallway. We're actually working right now on two things. We've taken photographs of all of them. And actually, by the time this airs, it'll all be installed.
Yeah.
But we've taken photographs. We're going to put them in Lightroom and organize them so that the flow is easy. And we're also cutting all of the boards that are the mounting units for them. So that's what I was working on this morning.
It has not been an easy feat for Stephanie and her team. I know this. We actually opened that bridge in January of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, we contemplated what's that next step. So after the survey of employees, I reached out to Stephanie and other schools. But, you know, Stephanie and that team, they were highly engaged immediately, came onto the site, you know, asked those questions that were important to community and to the patients we served. And it just felt like a great fit. You know, the timing for the art camp was the exact timing we needed.
The stars were aligned.
They were. It literally felt like everything fell into place. And I'll say it, you know, this was my first major art work initiative for me personally. And this process with Ivy Tech and Stephanie and her team has been, it's been a great experience. One of the things that I was most impressed about was the schematics that we had for the bridge. They blew up for the students and put it down a hallway. They also identified the artists that we have in our galleries. So we have three facilities with multiple artists, but they took the art and they blew it up for students to see. So the students could see every aspect of the bridge. They understood that patients are coming through and likely critical.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all explained to those who were working on the art. And then, so from that, they knew the style of the different artists and were able to visualize it with what you had put up, Stephanie. So the process has been great. And we have an open house December 4th. Mm-hmm. It'll be a closed open house to Ivy Tech, all of the artists, students, faculty, everybody that has worked on this initiative, along with key stakeholders in the art community and community health network staff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But we're excited to do the unveiling on December 4th.
Right. And we do know that by that Thursday of Art Camp Week, we had put in over about 1,200 hours.
Wow.
On the project. And that's not counting any of the meetings that the faculty and I had and students and I had beforehand. And I have only been keeping track since. I haven't added it all up. It's been a massive undertaking, and I don't think our students realize how amazing this opportunity is to create a piece of public art. I think they will when they get there and they see it, because we've created something that can change lives. And that's what Ivy Tech does. That's what community does.
Ivy Tech's Stephanie Lewis Robertson and Community North's Sarah Ward. You can see the artwork for yourself at a Community North open house on Monday evening, December 4th, from 4:30 to 5:30. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto, and I want to share a preview of an interview I recorded with Herb Miller. During the late 60s and early 70s, Herb Miller operated Lamp Records. Lamp Records released music from some of the best soul and funk artists in Indiana. While the quality of music released on Lamp was very high, the label only charted one national hit, It's Too Late for Love by the Indianapolis vocal group The Vanguards, which hit the top 40 in the spring of 1970. After only a few years in operation, Herb Miller closed up shop at Lamp Records and went back to his day job as an arson investigator for the Indianapolis Fire Department. I asked Herb why he quit the music business.
This was all going on at a time where I had a lot going on. And I was on the arson division, the city's burning, you know, I mean, they had the big riot here and everything, and I had a lot of investigations going, and I'm trying to do the record business, and so I didn't really have time for some of the things that some of the people wanted me to do.
And Herb is going to share his thoughts on five classic recordings from the Lamp Records catalog.
The first one I want to ask you about is The Diplomats, who I had Rodney Stepp on the show, and Rodney Stepp went on to an amazing career in music, played with the Spinners.
Right.
And he was just a teenager when you put out this record. They were
That's
the
right.
Diplomatics. What do you remember about these guys?
Well, I remember there's another young group.
Yeah, teenagers.
You know,
yeah.
With another young group of teenagers. And all these kids, you know, it was, I'm talented, I want it now, and that's the way it has to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was no working your way up. But Rodney and all these kids were very talented musicians.
Another record I want to ask you about is The Pearls, because, you know, on some of the Lamp records, you receive a production or arranging credit, and on this record, you wrote the B-side, I think. Was it Shooting High? Is that the name of the song?
Yes.
For The Pearls? Yeah.
And I don't remember how that actually happened, but if someone wrote a song and they came to me and you wanted to produce it and I could put it out on the label, I worked with you. You know, and so that's what it was. I was working with people trying to make it happen. I wasn't looking for the whole pie, you know. Mm-hmm. I could be the pie pan or the crust or the filling, whatever you wanted me to be, as long as I'm part of it. Let's do what we have to do to make it happen. And that's how I operate. That's the reason I'm not producing on some of the record, but I had the label.
Sure. another girl group on the label was the Indies, who did a cover of the Supreme song, and they got a pretty big push from the label. I think you took out an ad for them at one point in the recorder. What do you remember about the Indies?
Well, and I remember the Indies. Now, they had, I don't remember, that was Lemuel Dorsey and Lemuel and Lonnie Dorsey were pushing that group, but some of these people had other people back there pushing the group. And all I was the method for getting the music out. And I didn't have any direct control of the management of the group. So I was just the method to get the music out.
Sure. The Monteeks. Do you remember the Monteeks? Anything about them?
The Monteeks, right. Yeah. Same thing.
Yeah, vocal group also.
Right.
These guys were a pretty big act here in Indianapolis, and I think, and in Central Indiana, and I think this was one of the early records you released, but the Turner brothers, Allison and Calvin Turner.
Allison and Calvin Turner,
what do you remember about them?
If I remember, they were from Anderson, Indiana.
Yes, that's right.
Another group. I mean, they came in with their own thing. They came in with their own package.
We just heard five songs with Lamp Records co-founder Herb Miller. You could catch my full interview with Herb Miller on Cultural Manifesto in 2018.
My baby left me with his awful memories. She told me that she loved me.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Mark Allen, Jill Dittmeyer, and Shannon Forsell. You can hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, Carmel's new nod to the traditional German Christmas market, how to get circus skills right here in Indy, and two books that might be the perfect presents for people on your list. And, of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.